This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to the program, but I have to tell you, sometimes my research for Radio EcoShock gives me a sickening feeling, like I'm falling into a bad hole. We all are when it comes to the developing climate shift. This time, it's a new article published in October by Kevin Anderson. In the UK, he's a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester and deputy director of the renowned Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. His co-author is Glenn Peters, a senior researcher for CICERO, the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, Norway. The title of the paper is deceptively simple, The Trouble with Negative Emissions. It's big trouble. We've had Dr. Anderson on Radio EcoShock before. He's very popular. I've run a speech or two by him. He's a truth teller who is somehow tolerated by the highest levels of established science in the UK and now in Sweden. Anderson has recently become the second person to hold the Zennström Visiting Professorship in Climate Change Leadership at Uppsala University. As I read further into the new article by Anderson and Peters, what began as a sense of unease quickly developed into full-blown horror. Every few paragraphs I had to walk away to recover a little before continuing. It's not that we're being lied to on a massive scale. We are. But that's not the point. We're lying to ourselves on a massive scale. The agreement reached by our political leaders in Paris and now in Marrakesh reflects our own unwillingness to make deep changes now to save the climate. As we see in this paper, it also marks our very human way of answering a real threat with procrastination and fantasy. But first, of course, we fell into talking about the climate impact of the election of Donald Trump, with Kevin saying,
"Yes, I mean, I keep trying to. A lot of, where I am here, a lot of people are very sort of depressed by it, and I keep trying to emphasise that it is important. But let's be clear about this: about 60 million people of the world's 7.4 billion voted for Trump. The US has a population of 320 million, so 7.1 billion are not Americans. If America decides collectively to go down a different route, let's just have the 7.1 billion of us just get on with it." We spend far too much time worrying about this 320 million people. We have done historically, and I think it's about time the rest of us start to think, well, okay, I mean, if it wants to take a different route, it can. No doubt there'll be mayors and other people in the States, there are plenty of progressive people there, who will engage anyway, regardless of what Trump and the government are doing.
Well, a sort of wall may be built around America to kind of contain that madness while the rising seas continue and the heat waves continue. I mean, right now, it was 70 degrees here yesterday in Canada in November, in my part of Canada, and there's fires burning in the Appalachian Mountains also in November. Crazy weather, really.
Yeah, Florida. I mean, Florida voted Trump. But I mean, Florida's having a lot of problems, isn't it, with flooding and so forth.
They're doomed. Yeah. Miami is doomed, literally.
Yeah.
All right. That's the choice they've made for now. Perhaps darkest before the dawn theory, that they'll go through some terrible times and then finally get the real progressive leaders they need in 4 years' time. We shall see.
Yes. Yeah, but from a carbon budget point of view, that's quite an important period. But yes, yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. All right. We're speaking with Kevin Anderson at Uppsala, 70 miles north of Stockholm. Kevin, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Good evening. It's nice to be back.
Well, world leaders are meeting in Marrakesh, Morocco, for the 22nd Conference of the Parties. Are there plans to keep global warming below 2 degrees C based on a bit of a fantasy?
I think the underlying plans are. But by saying that, I'm not saying that 2 degrees C is necessarily a fantasy. I think that is still a viable goal with more reasoned but incredibly challenging plans. But I think at the moment, what the underlying premise of all of the enthusiasm around the agreements made in Paris is that we're going to rely on these negative emission technologies that do not yet exist in any scale. They are at best a pilot level, but many of them are still on the sketchbook in the laboratories. And we're going to rely on these to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the future as an excuse or a reason for inaction today, or at least relatively small sort of incremental action today. So I think 2 degrees C remains a viable goal. and it remains a viable goal without these negative emission technologies. But at the moment, what is happening is the negative emission technologies themselves are already undermining the need for serious mitigation today.
Can you give us some examples of negative emission technologies so we know what we're talking about?
Well, there are a whole suite of them. And you know, some of the more exotic ones are direct air capture. So we're going to find some way to suck air through, say artificial trees. Some people talk about them like that. Through artificial trees over some membranes that will either have some liquid or some other material in there, which will absorb the carbon dioxide from the air as the air passes over it. You then can heat up that catalyst and take out the carbon dioxide. You capture the carbon dioxide, therefore you liquefy it or almost liquefy it, and you can store it underground somewhere. So you have this ongoing process of sucking carbon dioxide out of the air through these devices. But this requires a lot of energy to operate these. And the idea is this would be renewable energy, which, of course, we don't yet have that much of. And you'd have to have huge numbers of these plants all over the planet to absorb this amount of carbon dioxide that would be needed. There are other ones like the iron fertilization, increasing the amount of iron in some parts of the oceans where there's a deficiency of iron, if you see it in that way. And by putting more iron in there, you increase the amount of biomass, phytoplankton, and so forth. And as this phytoplankton and biomass dies, the theory is that it will drop down to the bottom of the ocean, sucking the carbon dioxide down with it as it goes, because, of course, as it grew, it was through photosynthesis, it was removing carbon dioxide from the air. This has been tried in small sample tests, and it hasn't proved to be as successful as people thought it would be. And biochar is another way where we burn biomass material. That could be waste products from farms or, indeed, timber and other plant material. You burn it in a sort of an absence of oxygen, and then it's called pyrolyzing it, and then you put that into the soil. That can improve the quality of the soil sometimes, and you can lock in some carbon in the soil. And there are questions about how much you lock in, how resilient and robust is that, and there's still quite a lot of scientific uncertainty around it, but that's another option. But the one that is most commonly used in the models, in fact, most commonly, it's almost the only one that's used at scale within the models that advise governments on climate change, is something called BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And here you grow biomass around the planet, you then harvest that, and as it grows, it absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through photosynthesis. You then harvest that plant material, you convert it into some useful fuel form, like pelletize it or something like that. You transport it around the world in ships, you put it into trains, you take it to the power stations, you burn it in the power stations, and as you burn it, you then capture the carbon dioxide that is released into the chimneys, you liquefy the carbon dioxide, and then you pump it down pipes, and again, store it underground for a few thousand years. So that's the other technique, and that's the one that dominates the models that are used to advise governments, this BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And none of these technologies are up at any scale. Most of them are just sort of laboratory level at best. There are one or two preliminary pilot experiments with BECCS, but nothing of any size on any power stations. And indeed, carbon capture storage itself using fossil fuels is still undergoing quite a lot of experimental work, and there was only really one reasonable size plant available globally looking at that, but that's just standard carbon capture and storage from a power station. So there's a lot of work to be done of all of the technical elements of these, even though in theory at least, in a textbook, each of these things works in isolation. But at scale and collectively, there are no examples of these technologies.
I'm not a fan of building another industrial infrastructure in order to handle the problems of industrial infrastructure, but I am kind of friendly towards the French 4 per 1,000 plan to get more carbon back into the soil by changing some things about agriculture. What do you think about that?
Well, I would go a little further and say that, yes, I'm not particularly against negative emission technologies. I mean, I think they are a little bit of a sticking plaster, but I'm not saying that we shouldn't consider them, we shouldn't research them and potentially deploy them. And some certainly the ones that are the most or have the least impact on the rest of the ecosystems, the better, really. So I think the French system is one we can seriously consider. We have to be also quite careful about how long are we locking the carbon into the soils for. Is it resilient when we try to do that? And even the planting of trees, which seems like a very obvious thing to do, and in fact I'm very much in favor of planting a lot more trees, but mostly for biodiversity reasons. When we plant a tree, it sucks the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere over, say, the next 30, 40 years. But if we take a flight or we drive a car, we emit directly into the atmosphere today. And I don't think it's the same thing to say I'm emitting today and I will suck the CO2 out over the next 40 years. You know, the pests might move around the planet as the temperature changes, which undoubtedly will continue to change. Water patterns may move through rainfall and so forth. We might get a lot more migration of one sort or another. Trees could be chopped down to become fuel lava. So there could be a whole suite of reasons as to why over that 40 years things could change sufficiently that these actually trees are not allowed the 40 years to absorb the carbon dioxide. As I say, they could simply be killed by new pests that we hadn't expected to move. And we're already seeing a lot of tree damage in quite a lot of parts of Europe by movements of pests that may not be exacerbated by climate change. So I'm all for trying these techniques, but I do not think we should consider any of them substitutes for actual mitigation today. And that's my and Glenn's very strong message from our paper, that we need to mitigate, you know, proper mitigation, i.e. do not release the emissions today, rather than release them today and find some other technique to remove them from the atmosphere in the future.
Well, Kevin, I have been working my way through a series of scientists and new papers on the reaction of the plant world to climate change. In recent interviews, Scotland's Dr. James Curran and from the U.S. Dr. Isabel Montagnes both conclude we face significant risks of escalating greenhouse gases, not just because of fossil fuels, but due to changes in the plant world. And I notice that your co-author, Glenn Peters, along with C.D. Jones of the UK Met Office, released a paper this year which said, and I quote, Earth system models suggest significant weakening, even potential reversal, of the ocean and land sinks under future low-emission scenarios. I'm not sure what that means. What does it mean?
Well, my interpretation of this, I should have spoken to Glenn about this before and I haven't, but I also know, Chris Jones has some really good, thorough work from the UK on this. What we know at the moment is that we are seeing some fertilization of plants. So actually the plants are absorbing slightly more CO2 than they would be before because of the raised CO2 levels in the atmosphere. But there's a lot of uncertainty around the details here. What is estimated from the experts in these fields, and I think it's fair to say there's still a lot of scientific uncertainty. As temperature changes, as we see increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere and so forth, these are going to be could possibly lead to some of the major sinks, and the principal sinks are oceans, which absorb in the region of about 10 billion tons, slightly under, of carbon dioxide every year, and land sinks, by and large, plants growing, which absorb about another 10 billion tons, that as we see additional warming and other changes in the climate, that these could start to end up not absorbing as much carbon dioxide. Now, with the oceans, we're already seeing this. As the oceans warm up, just a little bit, they cannot hold as much carbon dioxide as they do at the moment. So the other thing you start to get, we've seen this, I think, in one or two of the oceans now, is the changes in wind patterns across the surface of the oceans means that the oceans are not taking up carbon dioxide in the way they were previously, and we believe that the changes in some of these wind patterns are already a consequence of climate change. So what you have here, a whole set of quite complex phenomena that are going on, and the best interpretation of the science is that there is a serious risk that these sinks will not be able to absorb as much carbon dioxide in the future as they do today. So that means that for every ton that we put out, less of that will be absorbed and therefore more of it remains in the atmosphere and therefore you get an even higher increase in the amount of additional warming. So that's really what we're talking about here. And it is a major issue. At the moment, we put into the atmosphere about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year and about 20 billion tons are absorbed by oceans and plants. And if they start to absorb less, more of that 40 billion tons will remain in the atmosphere with adding additional warming.
Well, I worry with large natural feedbacks looming, whether it's in the Arctic or from permaculture or from permafrost. I worry that officials have wildly underestimated likely emissions. What do you think?
Well, we have to be quite careful here. Science is innately conservative, and rightly so. It is a slow, rigorous process of hypothesis and theories and testing and so forth. And that is correct, and that's how it should be. The problem is that there's always at the sort of forefront of science, there are things that people are looking at that are not perhaps fully quantified. They may often be quite well understood, like some of these feedbacks that you're talking about, but they may not be adequately quantified to include in the models. So what we have here, this is in the pure climate models, you have a whole suite of these feedbacks that we know exist, the majority of which make the situation worse. I mean, the obvious one that people will have quite possibly heard of is the melting of permafrost and the increased release of methane, a very powerful greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. Now, there are sufficient level of understanding of that to know that it's a serious risk, but we haven't been able to quantify it robustly for different temperature thresholds, and therefore you cannot embed that sort of feedback robustly in the models. So the models generally are quite conservative, and when they develop their carbon budgets from those models, of course, those carbon budgets are then therefore quite conservative. So we always have to have alongside that a recognition that there are a suite of feedbacks that can make the situation better or worse. But overall, our understanding is these feedbacks will make the situation worse. So we have conservative carbon budgets, and our understanding of the rest of the feedback mechanisms suggests that they could actually be significantly reduced because of these other concerns, these other feedbacks.
So we could burn much less carbon, really. So how likely is it, in your opinion, that we'll find a technology even larger than these mass natural systems like plants and ocean life and ocean currents?
Well, firstly, can you find it? I mean, I think can we find them at that scale? I think we can find technologies that will do this. So this is why I say I find we should carry on researching them and so forth. The question then is, can you, and this is often the problem between science and technology and then actually engineering it in reality, can you build them fast enough? Can you build them at all? Does the infrastructure cause you lots of problems when you're trying to put that in place? And then you've got other questions. You know, does it technically work? Is it very inefficient? Can you absorb as much as this as is assumed in the integrated assessment models, which are different to the climate models? These are the main integrated assessment models, are the models where the climate comes together, the economists, people looking at the technologies, and these are the ones that they use to advise governments. They're assuming very high levels of negative emission technologies. And when you look at the technologies and you look at what's assumed in the models, you think, can you actually build them that fast? And some of the provisional work that Glenn and I are doing suggests that as early as 2025, you'd have to be rolling these out at several very large plants every few days. So, I mean, it just looks completely unrealistic just to be able to deliver them, let alone at the moment there's a high level of uncertainty about whether these technologies would actually work at all. So I don't think we should just sort of park them and forget that they're there. I think we should be researching them, but we should mitigate as if they will not work. The assumptions in the models are absolutely huge in terms of the level that they uptake of these technologies. They're going to be built very rapidly, starting within 10 years from today, and keep rolling them out right on beyond the end of the century. So think about that. We are saying because we are not prepared to mitigate today, we're going to carry on removing CO2 from the atmosphere right through beyond the end of the century. By the middle of the century, many of the models assume that the technology that we would have developed on our planet will be absorbing as much as all of the oceans do today. That's about 10 billion tons. By the end of the century, quite a few of the models have us at 20 billion tons. In other words, it's like having another biosphere that has been towed in next to our planet that will absorb the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere. All of this is because we're not prepared to make the really deep, rapid changes that we could make today in order to hold it to 2 degrees centigrade. So I think there is a real risk of these technologies, not only not working, but actually that they are undermining our mitigation agenda today.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Kevin Anderson from the University of Manchester, the UK's Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, and now Uppsala University in Sweden. You know, reading your paper, Kevin, The Trouble with Negative Emissions, I was reminded again of the nuclear mess. You know, ever since I was a child, we were told a safe technology for storage of radioactive waste would be found soon. It's not here, and the nuclear plants are piling up with spent fuel. So do you think that's a good parallel to the emissions game?
Like with all parallels, all metaphors, they hold to a degree and then they collapse. I mean, no metaphor is ever a perfect replication of the real issue you're looking at. So I think there are certainly some similarities there. Some of the sort of the technological optimism we went with nuclear power, I think, is actually just the same as we have today with the negative emission technologies. And indeed, we had 15 or 20 years ago with nuclear fusion as well. So we often hear of, you know, these technical silver bullets. And I'm sure that a lot of people involved with them are always very well-meaning, but our sort of history suggests that technical silver bullets never work. Now, they may have a role to play, and sometimes they come up with other big issues that you have to deal with, like, for instance, the waste from nuclear power. Now, I think from the waste point of view, unlike the nuclear ones, which we didn't know what to do with then, and we still really don't know what to do with them today, when it comes to carbon dioxide, there's been a lot of work about where we would store these and how reliable those storage facilities would be. And when I say storage facilities, we're often talking about putting them down into what are called saline aquifers, big vents within the rock where there's often this salty water is there now, and you pump that out and put this liquefied CO2 in there. That is reasonably well understood from the geological point of view. We have some idea where some of these stores are. We can also use old oil and gas reservoirs. I think we have a better grasp of that than we do of the nuclear one for where we would put it. Nevertheless, there are still risks. If you're relying on this technology, it has to work with a high degree of security. You don't have ongoing small leakages. And I still think, you know, until we actually were doing this, we would not know for certain how robust and reliable it was. So there's another risk. But I think the risks from that side are less, and the unknowns are less than those associated with nuclear waste.
Well, I'm wondering how you and Glenn did this paper. How do you even calculate the risks of pathways relative to an untested technology?
Well, we don't look at it from a point of view of, well, we do and we don't look at it from a risk. We don't calculate the risk. We just look at the technologies, and you look at where are they today, and then you can say well, these are the technologies that are postulated, but they are theoretical or they're in a textbook. What are the problems with it? You can see a whole suite of problems with the technologies. So the BECCS one, which is used, the quantity of biomass is equivalent to 1 to 3 times the size of India, depending across the models. Most of the models are about 1 to 2 times the size of India, planted every single year, decade after decade, from about 2030, 2040, 2050 onwards towards the end of the century and beyond. So very large areas of the land put aside for biomass production. Some people have been pointing out, as we noted in the paper, that that level of biomass production itself has impacts on biodiversity, equivalent of almost a 3 degrees C of warming. So there's a whole series of these other negative repercussions of this negative technology. So when you look at all of that and put it all together, and there's still a lot of technical unknowns, as I said, with carbon capture and storage, and particularly when you start using heterogeneous biomass material, in other words, material from biomass which has different chemical constituents, it changes a lot over the seasons and water contents and so forth, compared with when you use a fossil fuel, which is generally the same chemical makeup or very similar chemical makeup all the time. And CCS is struggling with fossil fuels at the moment, let alone when we put this more uncertain biomass feedstock through it. We put all of this together, and what you have is a technology that is very uncertain. In terms of risk, we don't go then and try and say, how can we quantify that risk? No doubt some people would say that they could try to do that. I think it would be a real mistake. We cannot, in any meaningful sense, say what that risk would look like, other than the technology does not exist today. There are a whole series of unknowns. Some of the things that we do know, there are a lot of uncertainties around it. So, from any remotely precautionary approach, you might say, research them, but do not assume that they work. And that broadly is our fundamental message here.
There were immediate critics of your paper, mainly from other scientists who are working on negative emissions tech or who think we need geoengineering as quickly as possible. How do you answer criticism that your paper may endanger our best hopes?
Well, actually, a letter has been submitted to Science, and it will be coming out, I think, on the 11th of this month with our response to it. And what is interesting was you read the letter, that I think the letter, and people can make their own judgment of this, has, I wouldn't say it deliberately done this, but it has misunderstood what we've said. And I think partly because a lot of the people, which there were a lot of people that signed the letter, who were involved with the letter, are people who work on negative emissions. And I think they just saw us as immediately criticizing it. So to some extent, they saw red when they saw the letter. What we say in the letter, and they're particularly indignant about this idea of it being a moral hazard, is that they said, Anderson and Peters say that negative emission technologies are a moral hazard. We never said that. What we said was, if we rely on negative emission technologies, then that is a moral hazard. And that's a big difference between the two. We're not saying the technology is. We're saying the reliance on that technology, which does not yet exist, and there are lots of uncertainties of whether it could be developed and certainly at scale, then relying on that, that is the moral hazard. So I think there's been some misunderstanding of what we're saying in the letter. And as we've pointed out in our response, we are in favor of these scientists continuing to receive some funding and continue to do their research. What we are not in favor of is to assume that they work in the models that we are using to advise governments. And many of the policymakers have absolutely no idea these technologies are in there. When they are aware they're in there, they have no idea of the scale of which they're there. I recently attended a conference in Oxford, the 1.5 degree C conference, looking at these sorts of technologies. And some of the people were talking about, from the modeling point of view, were talking about how much was assumed to be captured. And you could almost see people spitting out the coffee. Some of the other earth scientists that were there, they themselves were not aware of the absolute scale that was assumed to be in the models. I mean, people, I know some of the ones that were there, I taught them during their breaks and so forth, sort of shaking their heads in despair that this could possibly be considered. And these are people working in the area. So I think what's happened is that these models have used this approach, and that many of the sort of Earth system climate scientists haven't been even aware that they were used at this sort of scale, even if they were sort of broadly aware that there was some discussion around them. So I think it's very unlikely that the policymakers have any grasp at all of what is underpinning the advice that they're receiving from this particular group of modelers, the integrated assessment modelers.
Well, great, because the IPCC reports and the Paris agreements and the talks going on now, they're all based on this assumption that we're going to have this wonderful technology at very high levels, and you found that that may not be realistic, and it's stalling action.
Well, indeed, that is a real risk. You captured it very well there. I think that is our concern. Is it both? It stalls action today, which would be fine if we knew they would work. And if they do work and they've stalled action today, then yeah, okay, we've stalled action and we get a bit more emissions than we would have otherwise got. If we stall action today and they don't work, and there's a very serious risk that they will not work at scale, then what we have done is passed on an appalling legacy to future generations and to the poor and climatically vulnerable people around the planet. We'll have handed them the worst of everything we could possibly imagine, all the things we have tried to say that we should try to avoid at Paris. We'll have effectively put back on the table the business-as-usual sort of scenario, 3-4 degrees C warming, if not more, by the end of the century.
Well, to put you on the spot, you're one of the few top climate scientists to say it's hypocritical to fly to climate meetings all over the world. You took a boat to a presentation in Iceland. How are you getting to Uppsala for your new appointment there?
Well, I do 2 months here, 2 months in the UK, so it's not too bad. So what I do is I just get the train over, which takes me about 2 days to come here. But I mean, you get a lot of work done on the train, so I probably had to end up doing 18-hour days on the train because you just sit there working, because you either do that or you look out the window. So from a productive point of view, it's good value for money in terms of travel time. It's a bit inconvenient. It means I can't travel back to see my partner so often in the UK. I just basically will do the 2 months here and then 2 months back in the UK. I do think those of us who work on climate change and think these issues are very serious, and I don't just mean the academics, I mean the NGOs and some people in the business community and even some of the policymakers, need to demonstrate that we think it's that important that we will make adjustments to our lives that we expect other people to make to their lives. And there's a very interesting paper that came out earlier this year when they actually were trying to assess this. I mean, it's a peer-reviewed academic paper, and what they found was there was a very clear improvement in the credibility of the research from academics who had actually made some attempt to reduce their own carbon footprint. So although obviously reducing your carbon footprint doesn't change the veracity, the appropriateness of your research, it does change the credibility with which your research is seen by others. So I think it's just part of the message and part of the communication that we need to demonstrate as a community, the climate change community, that we can do climate change work and climate change communication, we can engage with each other and with policymakers through much lower carbon means than we are doing today. Universities should be doing this much more widely as well. And that if we can't do it, why on earth should we expect any other sector in society to start to demonstrate some leadership? And some people say, well, it has to be top down. It has to be led by governments. Governments very seldom lead in isolation. Governments mostly see good examples elsewhere and then see how can we scale those things up. So I think there are plenty of ways that we can engage as academics, we can carry on good quality work and have much, much lower emissions. It is personally more challenging. It takes up more of our time. It can be inconvenient. It can be difficult when you've got families. But I think played against the impacts of climate change hitting some of the more poor and climatically vulnerable parts of the world, those inconveniences for those of us that are the wealthy high emitters pale into insignificance compared with people in Bangladesh living within 1 meter sea level rise of the strip of Bangladesh, about 30 million people or so, living with 3 degrees C or more and increased storm activity. So I think I think it's incumbent on us to demonstrate some leadership, and that leadership will contribute to catalyzing wider system scale change.
Actually, I just spoke with an expert on Vietnam who said that he thought that the Mekong Delta would be hit even before the Bangladesh area, as far as 3 to 5 million people having to leave. As we wrap up, Kevin, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think I would say just not despair. I mean, I often get accused, probably rightly so in some respects, of the message I give is very stark and can leave people quite depressed, really. But there are, I work on climate change because I think there are messages of hope. We are choosing to fail, and I think we will ultimately choose to fail. But because we are choosing, that means that we could change that choice. We could choose to succeed. And that choice to succeed is something incumbent on all of us, not just on governments. All of us have the agency to be people that can start to change things, not only in our own lives. I don't mean just about our local emissions. They, important though they might be for some of us, but by and large, I'm talking about by changing our lives and talking vociferously with it, with our colleagues, with people at work, with our friends, our sports clubs, with other members of our family, engaging with the policy, local policymakers, even engaging with national policymakers. All of this is part of the process by which we can all have a role to play. Leadership does not necessarily come from the top down. It can come from the bottom up. And the little story I always use for this is Mary Manning, who was a cashier at Dunn's Stores in a Southern Irish major store back in the time of apartheid. And she refused to put apartheid goods through her till, and she was sacked. She started the campaign. Other people joined her. Within 6 months, Dunn's had changed its policy. Within 2 years, the Irish government brought in some laws that no longer meant they would import goods from apartheid South Africa. This is a cashier that changed national law. And I think there are many opportunities for us all to have those sorts of changes across our system. So my positive message here is that we are all catalysts for change, but we have to start to demonstrate that change ourselves and then talk vociferously with colleagues and friends around us.
We've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Anderson, a top climate scientist in the UK and now in Sweden as well. He's a professor at the University of Manchester, deputy director of the Tyndall Centre. And we've been discussing his new paper, The Trouble with Negative Emissions. Find links to that and more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, partner. Is dangerous nuclear waste cluttering up your backyard? Well, come on down to West Texas, where you can park anything, maybe forever. Just stick that high-level waste on a train and get the government to pick up the tab. Since our big daddy billionaire bought the governor, we're open for radioactive business. There's acres to choose from with America's biggest nuclear parking lot. Old reactor parts, nuclear cores, or weapons waste ticking away at your place? No problem. Yes, get your atomic junk down to Andrews County, where Texas love anybody's nuclear waste.
We are Texas. We love your hot nuke waste.
Well, maybe you missed that parody ad from waste control specialists, but four nuclear watchdog groups didn't. We've reached another nuclear waste specialist, Kevin Camps, from the nonprofit group Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
What nuclear goodies are lined up for the lucky people of Texas?
Well, the crisis du jour is commercial irradiated nuclear fuel, which is high-level radioactive waste. It is sometimes called spent nuclear fuel, but that's a euphemism. And even worse, it's called used nuclear fuel. So this is dangerous stuff. It could deliver a fatal dose of gamma radiation at short distance with no radiation shielding in a matter of seconds, or minutes, perhaps, if it's decayed for some decades. But it's very dangerous outside of radiation shielding. And then in the long term, you've got the alpha emitters, things like plutonium, and that's going to remain hazardous literally for hundreds of thousands to a million years.
Where is Andrews County, Texas, and what does it look like around there?
Andrews County, Texas is extreme West Texas in the Texas Panhandle region. It's right on the border with New Mexico. It is an arid region, and there's a lot of mineral exploitation and fossil fuel exploitation that goes on out there. But significantly, in terms of the environment, right underneath waste control specialists is the Oglala Aquifer. This is the southernmost reaches of the Oglala, and it's named Oglala after the Sioux tribe in the Dakotas because it stretches all that way up. So we're talking several states on the Great Plains that depend on the Oglala for drinking water and irrigation water, and that is going to be put at even worse risk by this proposal. But they're already dumping so-called low-level radioactive wastes, and you mentioned even nuclear weapons wastes have been moved to the WCS site. So the Oglala is very much at risk from all these schemes.
Who founded this company, Waste Control Specialists, or WCS?
Well, a certain Dallas billionaire named Simmons, whose other claim to infamy was that he was behind the swift voting of John Kerry 12 years ago today, when Kerry's Vietnam War record was called into question, his Purple Hearts were called into question. It turned out to all be bogus, but that was Simmons, and after he did that, and George W. Bush, retained the presidency, then Simmons went on to found this company called Waste Control Specialists, and it has really become a national dump site for radioactive wastes of various categories. You've got all categories of low-level waste. That's A, B, and C, A being the lowest, C being the hottest. And you've even got, as I mentioned, the nuclear weapons waste coming in from places like Los Alamos. And what's crazy about that is these are the barrels of plutonium-contaminated weapons waste that are at risk of bursting. There was a burst of one of these barrels deep in the underground at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico on Valentine's Day of 2012, and that single barrel bursting 2,000 feet below the surface of the land will cost $2 billion, with a B, to recover from, if they can even recover from it. They may have to close that dump down completely, which would be an even bigger monetary loss. That's what they've got down there at Waste Control Specialists, except instead of being 2,000 feet beneath the surface, it is literally a couple inches beneath the surface. The only reason they put it 2 inches beneath the surface, essentially they covered it with dirt, is because they had put it inside concrete overpacks that were painted black. We're talking West Texas. So in the summers of 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, over 100 barrels of plutonium wastes that could burst their barrels were out in the hot Texas sun in a black container. And Los Alamos National Lab, the culprit behind the bursting barrel controversy, had to intervene and beg and plead and get WCS to put these barrels at least under a couple inches of dirt to try to prevent the sun from igniting them.
Now, my understanding is that this was actually a Texas state facility that somehow ended up as a private company approved to accept nuclear materials from all over the country. Could you trace the process of how did that happen?
Well, there is this law, the low-level radioactive waste law of the United States, which called for either states to handle their own radioactive waste problem in the low-level realm. So-called, because low-level is very dangerous still, but it's not as dangerous as high-level. It's just less concentrated. But if states wanted to, they could also form compacts of states. And Texas went that route. They formed a compact with the states of Maine and Vermont, if you can believe that, thousands of miles away. The three states got together and said, we're gonna establish one dump to serve all three states. And the way that works is the other states that aren't hosting the dump pay more money to use the dump. So Texas became the target, and it was very quickly privatized. That's when Simmons stepped in. But Texas still played the role in terms of state regulators having to approve this thing to open. And that's when the Oglala controversy struck. And three lifetime staffers at the Texas Environmental Agency, the state agency, resigned their jobs over the opening of this dump. And, their director, who was an appointee of a Republican governor, who was close friends with Simmons, as many Republicans are in Texas, at the highest levels of politics, they resigned, but the director approved the thing over their heads, and away we go, dumping radioactive wastes above the Oglala Aquifer.
And one of the commissioners appointed by Governor Perry, who incidentally received lots of campaign contributions from Harold Simmons, actually then became a lobbyist for this company.
The revolving door in the nuclear industry is scandalous. And yeah, exactly. So, and it's not just a revolving door between, state politicians, their appointees at state regulatory agencies. This goes all the way to the top of the U.S. federal government. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the U.S. federal government, which also had to give its blessing to this scandal. You know, one of the worst examples of all was when an NRC commissioner named Jeffrey Merrifield passed through the revolving door after doing the dirty work for the industry. He changed the definition of the word construction in NRC regulations, which, long story short, exempted most of nuclear power plants' construction from the National Environmental Policy Act. It only applied to the reactor and the safety systems. Other major parts of nuclear plants, like the turbine hall or the transmission line corridor, were exempted. Don't even have to undergo a National Environmental Policy Act review. Away you go. Just break ground and, you know, build the thing and build momentum and facts on the ground and try stopping that nuclear plant now. And he went to work for a company called the Shaw Group that builds nuclear power plants. So that was a particularly egregious example. But Waste Control Specialists is also scandalously an example of this.
The Texans say they're merely offering, and I shouldn't say the Texans because this isn't the people of Texas. This is a little group of business people at this point. They say they're merely offering a nuclear parking lot. How long might this waste remain there?
It could stay there forever because once this waste moves to somewhere like Andrews County, Texas, which is a single congressional district, it's a sparsely populated area. Try moving this stuff someday. Even, you know, it would take all the pressure off finding a permanent solution like a deep geologic repository for this waste, which has been the plan for many decades. It would take all the pressure off doing that. And now the dynamic you've created is you've got the entire rest of the country just fine with the situation because it's in a single congressional district. So try moving it. You've got one member of Congress who maybe someday, except he's going to be getting campaign contributions from WCS, maybe someday he'll start asking or she'll start asking questions, why is the waste still here, you know, 50, 100 years in the future? Isn't it supposed to move to a permanent dump? Well, it would be one member of Congress versus 434 others in the U.S. House and two senators versus 98 others in the U.S. Senate. And guess what? It's going to stay right where it's at. Probably forever, at the surface.
Which was never planned, and it's a lousy solution. So who are the four groups who are now speaking out opposing this radioactive move to Texas?
Well, my group, Beyond Nuclear, and also Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And in Texas, we've got Public Citizen, which, yes, has a D.C. office, but also has a Texas office. And then another really great grassroots group in Texas called the SEED Coalition. That's for Sustainable Economic and Energy Development.
I think it's Sustainable Energy and Economic Development, isn't it?
Yes, you got it. Sorry.
Right. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Kevin Camps from the nonprofit group Beyond Nuclear. Well, Kevin, as you know, so-called spent nuclear fuel rods are piling up in cooling ponds at about 100 reactors in the United States with nowhere to go. And these older reactors are starting to put in more rods than some of the facilities were ever designed for. They're overloaded. So doesn't it make sense to get that nuclear waste out of more populated areas and into West Texas?
Well, you are right that the pools at operating nuclear power plants and even at permanently shut down nuclear power plants, many of them are packed to the gills, much more so than ever designed for. In fact, the density of the irradiated nuclear fuel in storage pools is approaching that of an operating reactor core. And they have to take extraordinary measures to prevent inadvertent nuclear criticalities in the pools. So the pools are very dangerous, and we've long called for the removal of the wastes from the pools into outdoor dry cask storage, which are concrete and steel silos that are air-cooled with convection currents. There's no moving parts. But even the dry cask storage in the United States, it has to be improved significantly because they're cutting corners to save money. But the nonsense of the centralized interim storage concept, I'll give you an example. There was a parking lot dump, as I call them, targeted at an Indian reservation in Utah, the Skull Valley Goshutes Reservation. This was a decade ago.
Dump nuclear waste on the Indians. I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
And it was actually approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They had a license to construct and operate the facility. It was going to be the same size as this one at WCS, so they've really modeled this one after the previous one there. And we stopped it. It was a huge coalition of environmental justice groups joining up with the likes of Mormon Republican politicians of the highest level, like Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, and we stopped the thing despite the licensing. And the absurdity was that if the waste had moved there, the plan was to send it to Yucca. But if Yucca were to be canceled, the plan was to return to Sunder. And so the classic example is Maine Yankee was a partner in this private fuel storage limited liability corporation. That would have been more than 50 train-sized containers of high-level radioactive waste transported 5,000 miles round trip, returned to Sunder, back to Maine because Yucca's canceled, accomplishing absolutely nothing except for putting hundreds of cities, towns, and villages at the risk of a nuclear waste transportation accident or attack. We call these shipments mobile Chernobyls because when they go wrong, a disaster could unfold in a heavily populated area.
And you never get that community back. I mean, people talk about cleaning up Fukushima. It never gets cleaned up. So do the communities along those rail lines get a say, or are they even warned that high-level nuclear materials are coming along the tracks?
No to both your questions, and it falls to groups like ours to warn people that this is even being considered and to try to activate them to take action before it's too late. And we've had to fight this battle. We call it the Mobile Chernobyl. We've had to fend off the Mobile Chernobyl countless times for the past two decades. And we've succeeded, sometimes by the skin of our teeth, as with Yucca, as with the Skull Valley parking lot dump. But we're going to, you know, redouble efforts, warn people across the country that this is coming their way, and it's only going to be stopped if folks along the transport routes rise up. Because when it comes to this nuclear waste transportation, you know, we all live in West Texas.
Suppose somebody at WCS gets a lot more high-level radioactive waste. Can they really stop terrorists from getting their hands on some of that?
Well, you know, I think the bigger danger from terrorism would be directly attacking it. Because, you know, one scenario is called the dirty bomb. And yeah, they could steal it, take it somewhere, and then it blow it up. Or what they could do is wait for the U.S. Department of Energy and waste control specialists to haul it through places like downtown Chicago and just attack it there. So these are potential dirty bombs, and the weapons that could breach these containers and release the contents are unfortunately quite available on the black market. I'm talking TOW anti-tank missiles that are available by the thousands on the international black market. A recent example comes from Syria, surprise, surprise, where ISIS overtook a more moderate rebel force and stole all their weapons away, including 500 anti-tank missiles. Now, you know, it would be a challenge for ISIS to get such weapons over here, but not an impossibility. And like I'm saying, all they'd have to do is set up shop in Chicago, for example, and wait for the federal government to bring them through on the train and attack it in downtown Chicago and impact, you know, a very large number of people.
Suppose there was an accident or some kind of meltdown or terrorist attack at the site in Andrews County. Is there any chance radiation could reach more populated areas like Dallas or even spread over the American South?
Yeah, it would depend on the weather conditions and it would depend on the size of the attack. But when you're concentrating, you know, as WCS wants to do, beginning with 5,000 metric tons, but going all the way up to 40,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste in one place, then it would depend on the size of the attack. And, you know, given the radioactivity content of this material, I mean, this would be a massive dirty bomb that you can't even comprehend. And so one of the attack scenarios that we've called for the U.S. federal government to take seriously is actually the use of a nuclear explosive against such a storage site, and to defend against that, because, you know, a nuclear explosive, granted, it does have radioactive fallout, but the radioactive fallout of a nuclear explosion would be small, very small, compared to the radioactivity content of this stored waste. I'm talking many orders of magnitude. I mean, when you think about it, a nuclear explosive will be some pounds or tens of pounds of uranium or plutonium. But what we're talking about at Waste Control Specialists is up to 40,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste. So when you defend against a nuclear explosive, you're defending against every lesser attack, too. And that's why we call for things like hardened on-site storage at the nuclear power plants, where you're defending against these kinds of attacks. And that's the real answer. Groups across the country, 200 environmental groups from all 50 states, have endorsed hardened on-site storage as an interim measure that would, you know, do away with these crazy calls for centralized interim storage.
And Kevin Camps, you've probably heard that a citizens panel set up by the government of South Australia has just slammed the idea of importing nuclear materials from all over the world as a business there.
Yeah, thankfully. I mean, as in the United States, Australia has been targeted for, in Australia's case, an international radioactive waste dump because they only have one or two small research reactors in Australia. So they don't have very much high-level radioactive waste there, relatively speaking. But they keep getting targeted by other countries and even by nuclear proponents within Australia. Australia is the major exporter of uranium in the world. So there's a uranium industry in Australia, and they would like to make money by importing other countries' radioactive waste. So it's very good news. I know the Green Party of Australia, which is a force down there, the original Green Party in the world, actually. The Germans went to Australia to learn how to do things back in the 70s. So they've played a big role in this recent victory down there.
Before we go, is there anything else you would like to tell us about?
Well, I'd just like to emphasize the victories we've won on this very issue of mobile Chernobyl and parking lot dumps. We have fended off many versions of this threat in the past. We're going to do it again. They often target Native American reservations. So if we do stop waste control specialists in Texas and a close runner-up proposal 50 miles away in Hobbs, New Mexico, it's called the Eddy and Lee Counties Energy Alliance, very close to the waste isolation pilot plant, they want to be a parking lot dump for commercial high-level radioactive waste. So it would become a nuclear sacrifice zone there on the Texas-New Mexico border. If we do stop these dumps, you can bet that the nuclear industry and its friends at the Department of Energy and Nuclear Regulatory Commission will then try to target Native American reservations yet again, and we'll have to stop that too, of course.
We've been talking with a longtime specialist in high-level nuclear waste management and transportation. He's Kevin Camps from the watchdog group Beyond Nuclear. I'll put links to this story and the groups involved in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Kevin, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Why does Donald Trump promote climate change as a hoax and conspiracy? He doesn't read much, and he certainly doesn't keep track of climate science, so he is an easy target for the deniers, just like his rural voters are. But Trump isn't quite that dumb either. The other answer may be he needed the money, and he needed an alternative media to capture the crown. So let me introduce you to the real multibillionaire behind the Donald's bluster about dismantling the Paris Climate Accord and closing down the EPA. Maybe you've heard about the big-spending casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson. He spends obscene amounts on Republican candidates. Surely you've heard of America's richest brothers, the Kochs, who spend their fossil profits on other Republicans. Nope. Here's a new one coming out of the woodwork. It's Robert Leroy Mercer. The Center for Responsive Politics says Mercer is the number one donor to federal candidates in the 2016 election cycle. Mercer gave failed candidate Ted Cruz about $11 million. Then he supported Donald Trump. Mercer funds the usual right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute. He also spends a lot on the fringe media outlet Breitbart.com. Andrew Breitbart has worked for the Drudge Report, and even after Breitbart's sudden death in 2012, the two sites linked back and forth with outlandish articles about Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump. Robert Mercer made his billions using computer power and mathematical skills to suck profits out of the financial transactions worldwide, stocks, bonds, derivatives, and all the gambling of Wall Street and the international markets were his target. With his PhD in computer science, Mercer joined a secretive company called Renaissance Technologies. That company is said to be worth somewhere between $30 and $65 billion, most of it owned by the employees, including now CEO Robert Mercer. In a word, he's the co-head of one of the world's most successful quant hedge funds. The employee investing vehicles at Renaissance Technologies, called the Medallion Fund, brags it has made 35% annually over a 25-year span. The company doesn't make any useful product. It siphons off money based on complex computer analysis, making automated bets. It's a kind of legal cyber piracy of the financial system. Robert Mercer pays some strange people, Donald Trump, of course, but Mercer also seems to want the death penalty, no gays, and lots of conspiracy theories tossed into the American population. I don't know if he believes these wild ideas himself, or if he merely thinks a population so distracted won't notice his money game and won't be able to make rational decisions to protect themselves from people like Robert Mercer. The Heritage Foundation, which Mercer helps fund with other billionaires, has been a hotel for climate deniers. But Mercer pays for weirder ones, too. In just two examples, he bankrolls a shadowy Arizona-based operation called Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. And according to Wikipedia, Fred Kelly Grant, an Idaho activist who encourages legal challenges to environmental laws. Doctors for Disaster Preparedness hands out annual awards to climate deniers and climate confusers like Fred S. Singer, Willie Soon, and Mark Morano. Mercer also funds a tiny group with an officious name, Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine. They also fund reports against climate change and environmentalism. I'll put a little spotlight on these weird offshoots of the Mercer family in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Here is how influential Mercer has been in the Donald phenomenon. According to Wiki, quote, Mercer is a major supporter of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign for president. Mercer and his daughter played a role in the elevation of Stephen Bannon and Kellyanne Conway into the senior roles in the Trump campaign. Mercer also finances a super PAC, Make America Number One, which supports Trump's campaign, end quote. So the Donald owes Robert Mercer. Apparently part of that price is to deny global warming and dismantle any world progress to fight off the coming climate catastrophe. You'd think a computer quant guy could figure out the science behind climate change and the odds, but apparently not, which shows a person can be very, very smart and still a little twisted. The world will survive. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week.
Troubled times, hearts can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas.